Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Especially in these tough times, most career-minded people are trying to stay a step ahead of the curve, and my guest can help us. Patrick Tucker is deputy editor of The Futurist magazine and content director of the World Future Society's website, WFS.org. Patrick's written prodigiously on topics ranging from artificial intelligence to genetics ethics, from climate change to demography. His works appeared in publications ranging from the Encyclopedia Britannica to the Utney Reader, and he's appeared on shows ranging from The Voice of America to Russia Today. From CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Osgood to Science Fantastic with Michio Kaku, Patrick Tucker, welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
My pleasure. Well, let's focus, you know, it's often been said that he who lives by the crystal ball eats broken glass, so we shouldn't look too far into the future. Let's kind of focus on the 2 to 10 year from now time frame. Let's start with, we're going to move to the non-science people later, but let's focus in the beginning on science and math-oriented people. For science and math-oriented people who are contemplating choosing a career, changing a career, what are 2 or 3 emerging careers that you think are worthy of consideration?
This is something that we've covered a lot in the Futurist magazine. So anybody that is pretty familiar with use the internet in a way to achieve a great effect is going to look forward to a really profitable next decade or so. One of the careers that was that came to us from Timothy Ferris. He's actually a best-selling author who's not particularly technologically minded, but is really innovative. He came up with a career called the personal reputation manager. So the scenario is sort of like this. It's the year 2030, and you're about 6 months away from having your child. What are you doing? You're going to meet with a certified digital identity planner, and that person is going to sort of take a look at all of your child's digital life going forward, which services they're going to subscribe to, which offers from different online companies they're going to want, and how to basically live in the digital world by pre-planning it now. So this is something that Timothy Ferris wrote for us for the year 2030. I thought it was this wonderful sort of mental leap. In terms of the next few years...
I want to understand that a little better. Before we go on to that, I know Tim Ferris, he's the author of The 4-Hour Workweek. He's the guy who's the big advocate of hiring a remote assistant in India to handle a lot of your $10 an hour work. But when you're saying personal reputation manager, identity, when I've heard of people who are reputation managers, and they are people who generally, you know, when you have somebody who writes a bad Yelp review, they help you figure out how to respond to it, that kind of thing. State again in really clearly, what does the Tim Ferriss's version of a personal reputation manager, identity planner do?
Okay. They take a look at what information about your child do you want recorded, searchable, and findable, omitted or deleted. They took a look at which companies and agencies will you have to periodically contact to request deletions, feed legal alternative misinformation, that sort of thing. And they look at what safeguards, whether software or human or behavioral, you can put in place to prevent older children or someone else from endangering themselves or others in the family. So in this way, they speak to a broader trend of more and more people spending more and more time online and just interacting with, a variety of different networks, a variety of different institutions and individuals around the globe, increasingly in, you know, the online space.
You're saying, let me interrupt you. You said you're a child. Why wouldn't we want to be doing this? Why don't we need to be doing this for ourselves as well as for our children? And maybe, yeah, why are you focusing on the child?
Well, he sort of took it, he looked at it as something that you would start doing for your child before they were even born. And it's something that we now do, sort of online reputation management is something that we do all the time. Companies have such a large digital fingerprint that they often, you know, sure. contract that work out to a lot of other people. But right. at this point, it's something that an average adult who lives a fairly boring life can do by themselves without a lot of hassle. But keep in mind that even your average person like you or I, I've been online, you know, for 15 years, and it's only really been interesting in the last 10 years. This is someone that's going to be online their entire life. Right. I mean, we're really talking about a phenomenon that even though you or I are fairly old, the phenomenon itself is really young.
So I want to understand. Let me understand this. So let me understand right. this. If I am, you say this is even before my child is born. So what am I going to want to do? I just want to make this clear. I don't normally go and, you know, probe this deeply because we got so much we want to cover, but I just want to right. make sure it's clear. So if I am let's say my wife is pregnant and we're about to have a child, why would I hire somebody to protect their reputation at that point when my child is a fetus?
Right. It's not
why?
Necessarily just a reputation. It's sort of laying out different ways that different companies, different entities, different institutions are going to be interacting with that person digitally and laying out different guidelines that the person will sort of carry with them throughout their lives. And, of course, they'll customize them more and more as they grow older. So in this, part of the reason we would want to do that is not just to protect the reputation of the fetus, which hasn't yet done anything and thus has no reputation,
right, exactly.
but also just to sort of, you know, create a broad architecture in which that child's interaction with the outside world in the digital space can be the most fruitful, can be the most safe, can be the most supportive. And this is because we spend a lot of time online, and increasingly this is where we're going to get more and more information. It's going to shape our worldview. The information that we get online, the institutions that we choose to interact with, we're going to make those choices based on information on marketing that occurs over a digital space as opposed to a more traditional medium. And so there's a lot of selection that has to happen.
Okay, I think I got it. So
right.
I think I got it. So I think what you're saying is the child from when they're, you know, starting to get on the internet at age 3 or 4 or 5
right.
is going to get bombarded by marketing efforts, nonprofit efforts, etc. And as the parent, you want to be able to, in the same way as parental controls on the TV set may screen that you want your child to watch Sesame Street, but not pro wrestling, there would be either the parent, or if the parent, it's beyond the parent's ability to hire somebody to kind of screen. So that the kid's internet access is what the parent would want. Is that correct?
That's kind of it. But at the same time, it's not just it becomes necessary because the involvement is two-way as opposed to one-way involvement, which is watching television. Mm-hmm. You sort of passively watch television, mm-hmm. and some of it's good and some of it's bad, and you can put a chip in your computer rather than have a person, you know, dictate what your kid watches. But when we interact online, we create data as we consume it. And that data creates sort of a broad sense of who we are, and different institutions, different social networks use that data in very different ways. And we're only beginning to understand the value of all of the data that we create and all of the data that we give to these different networks and institutions like Facebook. And that data that we create, that record that follows us around, really has a big effect and will have an increasingly large effect on the way we interact with other players in the digital space.
I got it. So it's not just on the receiving side. So in other words, we always hear as adults, we hear about, you know, be careful on your Facebook profile if you're interested in your career, posting yourself in the wet T-shirt contest.
That's an obvious one, right? Don't do that.
Right. And so this is a way of professionalizing both ends, both what comes into your child's inbox and kind of filtering or protecting what the child puts out, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
That exists in will grow in importance. So Timothy Ferris wrote that scenario for us, and he was looking at a career for the year 2030. In terms of what this trend that he's looking at, the far future of what that means for people looking at a career in the next 2 to 3 years. One area that I think is really interesting that deals directly with this is predictive analytics. So taking really large sets of data, this is something for sort of people that are math oriented or have any understanding of statistics. You don't have to be great with statistics, but you do have to know sort of what a data set is. Using that in order to help companies, they can be big, they can be small, to glean meaningful information from patterns. So this is something that only recently we've begun to get a sense of how large these data sets are, exactly how much and how nuanced the data is that we're collecting, and what you can do with it. I mean, there are patterns in this data that are useful in ways that we can only begin right now to imagine, but they make large areas of the future just sort of like much more visible. And all of this has tremendous value. We create it all the time. We create this data through our actions and through our exchanges, you know, with different networks, sometimes with sensors, sometimes with search engines. But that data actually has tremendous value.
Right.
And we've only begun to realize that it might be valuable to someone. So there is a couple of different interesting programs that offer a master's in predictive analytics. One comes out of Northwestern.
Before we get to the programs, let me, again, I want to try to make things really clear for the listeners. So bottom line, right now, everybody knows that when you go to Amazon, they will make recommended purchases for you based on what you purchased in the past. This is
right. What
you're describing as a fairly crude example of what they will be able to do in terms of predicting what you will be interested in, not only buying, but reading, etc., based not only on your previous purchases, but what your Google search, and a bunch of other psychographic information. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And we create so that the current Amazon algorithm to determine my preference for a different book based on my search history is, as you say, very crude. We know that a lot of the times the reason we buy a particular book or album or product is because information about that came to us through our social circle. And we've only begun to realize how, you know, social circle affects purchasing behavior. But it's certainly a lot more, the connection there is much higher than, you know, ads that come through your television that are just geared towards a general audience of, you know, 100 million Americans. So that customization of marketing exchange just gets much better, and it becomes better when you're able to find which data is appropriate, which data sets are appropriate, and use them to glean meaningful information. And that's a real area of growth in the future in the area of computer science or information technology.
Right. So let's draw that right to a career issue. We call those careers data mining careers, database management careers. And indeed, everything I've read has said that this is maybe the hottest area and likely to stay hot for the foreseeable future, the predictive analytics, looking for careers in data mining. You don't need a PhD in statistics, but yes, I would imagine that it helps not just to know about database programming, but having a statistical-oriented mindset, loving to investigate data, to create algorithms, to go and search through data, to do a better job of predicting what the customer is going to want to buy, read, etc. I think that's a great idea. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko.
Sorry, go ahead.
Let me let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Patrick Tucker. He is the deputy editor of The Futurist magazine and content director of the World Future Society's website, which is WFS.org. What were you going to say, Patrick?
I was just going to say that you're absolutely right. Though it is a technical area, it's not something the jobs that will be created will be across different educational levels. You'll probably work for somebody with a PhD at in some capacity in this, but the amount of data itself is so large that there are a number of different positions that can be created around getting the data, interacting with sensors, interacting with customers to get it, crunching it so that it comes in a suitable form that can be useful to someone else later. It's just too big. It's the grand endeavor of making knowable all human activity, you know, either because people are interacting with sensors or because they're interacting with different online agents. This is the activity that makes up our life, and it reveals a pattern. And there's so many ways to collect it and so many ways to record it and so much of it out there that it creates jobs for not just people with PhDs, but anybody that is interested in learning a bit more about it.
You know, putting myself in my listeners' shoes, the listeners to this show and tend to be not teenagers who are about to start and, you know, have the time to go and choose a major for undergraduate and go and get a master's degree or whatever. They tend to be from 30 to 70. And so they need to, in the context of their current life, in their current job, etc., they need to be able to take do their training on the fly, part-time, online, which is asynchronous and wonderful because you can do it at, you know, at midnight in your underwear rather than having to show up from 7 to 9 p.m. at on campus. You're pretty up on online programs. You mentioned to me on the phone, for example, Stanford's free artificial intelligence program as a way of getting up to speed. What else you want to tell us about, or a website where maybe some of the very best online training programs for these up-and-coming careers might be?
Well, the predictive analytics course that I was most interested in comes from Northwestern, and that's a full course, and they charge plenty of money for it. But if you just got a little bit of time and you're looking to sort of build up skills or just follow an interest in a particular area, right now on the Futurist website at WFS.org, I put a list up that I found from Open Culture, and it's
great.
400 online courses that you can download to iTunes, that you can watch on YouTube, 400-plus courses that will completely eat up the rest of your Sunday. They really, you know, run the gamut in terms of in the humanities and history, and also plenty of great technology, engineering, computer science stuff. Because that's the thing. A lot of people don't consider themselves necessarily technological, and this is because they had a terrible experience of learning science or math growing up, I think. I think that that's right. For the most part it, you know? I mean, when you're growing up, the humanities just appeal to us, to emerging human beings, because they, you know, light the imagination and give us ideas about the sort of human being we want to be, and, you know, help us understand this world that we're growing into in a way that, you know, our personal life experience doesn't. And it seems like science and technology really doesn't have that. And so there's a lot of kids that are just turned off by science and technology careers. But when you get older, I argue that that's the best time to begin learning about it, because this is when abstract, you know, rule-based systems, intellectual nuance and complexity, you know, following a task from beginning to end, your mind is actually much more suited to that when you get a little bit older. So this is for people that are in sort of their 30s, which I am, their 40s, their 50s, or their 60s, this is actually a great time to get into that, because you're bringing to the task of learning a literacy that you established somewhere else. But you're right. I think that as you get older, of course, there's a number of different obstacles that come in your way. You've already dedicated yourself to a position, and, you know, a lot of people have kids. They have mortgages. It can be very difficult to put all of that on the line to go pursue some sort of master's class elsewhere. So the programs that are really going to survive in the 21st century in terms of the educational institutions that are going to make the biggest impact on the lives of people are those that cater to exactly the person you mentioned, somebody that is perhaps looking to re-career into something a little bit different, something that different programs that offer convenience, that offer some sort of, you know, that capture all the great things that we like about interpersonal learning around the table, and turn that into something that people can do in all sorts of different environments and settings, and doesn't take a ton of money or a ton of time.
Yeah, Patrick, as you know, we have a lot we want to cover in this half hour, and so we've only got about 12 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you to be pretty concise, if you don't mind, so that our listeners can get as many nuggets that are practical takeaways for their career as possible. What emerging trends or careers that you see likely to be important in the area of what you've called autonomous transportation? Because that's an area you've spent time thinking about.
Right. So autonomous systems and robotics in general are going to impact, I think, a lot of different careers in many different ways. On our website right now, we're running a system that was designed by a great Australian urban planner. He's really young. His name is Charles Rattray, and he's basically designed a artificial intelligence car system for a city where it's made up of different pods, and the pods communicate with each other, very similar to the Google proposal for a self-driving car city via radio frequency. But because the cars are able to see one another and see the road, the, you know, sort of visible environment is much wider to them than it is for human beings, these units interact with each other in a way that is sort of resembles the way great big schools of fish interact. I mean, they're just constantly feeding off of one another, and this increases the safety of the road and increases the efficiency of all of these vehicles as they operate in tandem and reduces traffic. So how does this, it's a wonderful idea. How does this translate into a career? from a really technical, detailed perspective, learn about radio frequency identification, learn about artificial intelligence. And as these types of systems gain popularity or as they become more interesting to talk about from a policy angle, then you'll have a place to go. But also from a, you know, from an easier perspective, just look at something like community vehicle sharing. Because that's many ways the basis for this too. Because in the rat rate proposal, you don't own your own pod. Your pod is part of a fleet that you buy a subscription to. And these are really interesting ideas for transportation in the 21st century. We see more and more people moving away from the notion of individual car ownership and towards the idea of subscriber-based ownership. And so this is the sort of business that I think a regular person who's looking to, you know, show off entrepreneurial skills can invest themselves in a little bit.
Let me try to.
You don't have to actually create a huge AI car system that's going to race around. You can do what a couple of kids actually who went to Singularity University did last year. They created an app. You put it in a car. It dialogues with the car, and it interacts with this machine that you put inside the car. I got a little jumbled up there, but here's what it is. If I take my car to work and I want to rent it during the day, I can set up a website. I've got this little device in my car. I've got an app. Somebody comes to my website and says, I want to rent your car for the day while you're at work. I just need it for 2 hours. I can give them a key that they download on the app. They walk up to the car while I'm at work. They press the, you know, they lock in the code that I gave them, and they can take that car for the day. I don't have to make them a key. I don't have to worry about losing the key. I don't have to worry about what they're going to do with it, with that key later because it expires. So, and that's just something really simple that I think, you know, speaks to how people increasingly are looking to get around, and also the business models of the 21st century, which use technology in a simple way that's intuitive and fun and, you know, creates room for entrepreneurs.
I'd like to kind of build on that because, you know, what it's very easy for somebody who is the deputy editor of the a futurist and content director for the World Future Society to say, oh, it's easy, create an app that's going to enable people in their cars to be able to essentially lease out their car to somebody else while they're at work. But most people who are even quite intelligent and quite educated,
right,
are not going to do that. So I'm going to take a minute to try to riff what I think fairly non-technical people could do in this space. There's no question that the area of shared transportation, more and also frankly smart roads where there's more accident protection, and I also think there's no reason to limit it to roads. I do think we are going to have sky cars, the same radio frequency detection mechanisms that are going to enable cars to not bump into each other would enable individual small planes, if you will, flying cars to do the same thing and be very safe without having to build massive freeways and there'd be essentially massive virtual roads. But how?
See, now you're a futurist. There you go. You're completely.
Okay.
This is the hope of Robert Mueller. This is what he wants to do. He's the guy that invented the sky car, and it only works if he's got a gigantic sort of eye in the sky system that almost steers the cars for you so that people don't have as much control over them.
Right. But so I just want.
So back, I think that you're absolutely right. This is not everybody can create an awesome killer app like that. And I wouldn't recommend that for everybody, but I think that there's a lot of different ways where technology comes into our life and enables us to sort of enter into new career fields, especially for people that don't consider themselves really technological. And so the app, car sharing app that we were just talking about, you don't have to design it to be able to create a business around it. You can just be someone that has a car or has several cars and perhaps a certain amount of parking space in a city where you can leave that fleet for people to just come and sort of rent. I mean, it really decreases the cost that it takes to start a car company. Or let's take something that we know a lot of people are really good at, which is interacting with people personally. Let's take, like, say, the most non-technological job in the world, like being a home health aide, right? I mean, there's a certain amount of technology involved, but really what it is developing a rapport of trust with someone that needs physical assistance and being there when they need you and interacting with them personally and really getting into their life. I mean, would you agree that that's basically a really non-technological job, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So in Japan right now, there's a group called out of Kyoto It's a humanoid robotics group. And what they did was they created these sort of teleoperated robots, and they put them in places around Kyoto and also Nara, Japan, that are of historical significance. And what they do is, because a lot of the tour guides in these places are really old, Japan demographically is the oldest country in the world, and they can't get out as often as they used to give tours, these teleoperated robots serve as sort of that person's embodiment on the trail now. So they take people up to the mountain, they take people up to the great Nara Daibutsu, and they show it to them. And the person is there interacting with people and telling them about the history of Nara, through a telepresence. As these systems get better, more and more of that can be left to the robot, and the person just sort of, removes themselves more and more, which allows them to operate many, many more of these types of systems. Okay, so imagine you're a home healthcare person and you've got to be in two places at once, and a lot of home healthcare aides find themselves in this position if you've got more than one client. This is the sort of technology, it's a telepresence technology that's sort of bolstered by a robotic presence in the actual home that people can use to just increase their amount of business that they have, increase their effectiveness as a home healthcare aide. And learning how to interact with someone over that medium where you're not physically there, but your sort of presence is there from an IT perspective. It's your face, it's your voice, your awareness is there, but it's not quite you. This is a humanistic challenge. It's not a technological challenge. And so this is, I think, a great example of how people who aren't in traditionally technological fields can use technology and will be using technology in the next few years to just be more effective.
Patrick, I want to take a moment to tell my listeners a little bit even more practical. I am so painfully, I've been a career coach for a long time, and I've had 3,900 clients and some very smart clients, and some are entrepreneurial and some are technical, and many, many, many are neither. They need to work within the existing structure of an organization. They do have very soft skills, and I want to take a minute now to share with you, Patrick, as well as with my listeners, what those folks could do to capitalize on these trends. So, there is always a need for people in public policy. They need to understand the technology only well enough to explain it to other non-techies, whether they are policymakers or even in training. The ability to be an explainer is actually better done by somebody who is not a techno-geek, because you can then explain it in plain English. So you, my dear listeners, who are listening to this and saying it's really cool, but it's really too technical, I am not going to be able to develop an app of any sort. I am not going to, that's going to pay me middle class living, but you're a brilliant explainer. You are great at reading people's nonverbal communication skills where they're looking clueless. The opportunities as a lobbyist, as a policymaker, and as a trainer, and as a perhaps technical writer who can translate all of this into plain English, are opportunities for non-technical people. Does that make sense, Patrick?
That's basically what we endeavor to do all the time. I don't consider myself exactly a technical person. I become sort of increasingly interested in it. But the main thing that I see my job as doing is going to people with tremendous ideas and getting them to explain it to me as though I were an idiot, because that's pretty much the way I go about things, as a persistent idiot. I think that there's tremendous value in that. And this is what the Futurist magazine in many ways is all about, is taking the major trends of the 21st century and trying to put them into terms that a lot of different people can understand, people from 82 countries around the world, many of whom don't have a real full sense of English. We're trying to talk to them. At the same time, we're talking to people, inventors in Silicon Valley and in Boston, in a language that everyone can understand. So I think that's a hugely important area of the future. It's technical writing. In many ways, it might be technical blogging. It's social network outreach around technological devices. But, I think it's tremendously important, because these things are becoming more and more a part of our lives.
Because we're essentially out of time, I did spend some time looking at thefuturist.com, and there were three other careers. There was at least one other career I want to take the time to get your take on. It seems to me that there is no question that the world is headed toward more battery-centric things, electric cars, fuel cell-driven power plants, hybrid cars. So it seemed to me that the one area that almost is unquestionably going to boom is battery repair. I own a Prius. They tell me that if my central the central battery in my Prius goes away. It costs $3,000 to replace it with a new one. That's crazy. Right. I'm not going to do that. So it strikes me that lithium battery repair people, as fuel cells get developed, fuel cell repair people, and this is not going to require a PhD. This is the next generation technician job. What's your take on whether that's my vote for? I'm very bullish on that. Are you bullish on that? And if so, why? And what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, lithium ion battery repair, and I would also add lithium battery optimization. So taking a look at somebody's how they use their battery. Taking a record of it by just sort of, you can put a device on the device, or you can, you know, download a program to show how they're using their device and what sort of energy draw that they're getting off of it, and reporting back to them, here's some things that you can do to make your battery last a little longer. Mm-hmm. We've noticed the way you use your device, and we've got these recommendations for them. There's another one, and that would be an aspect of that career you just mentioned. But, lithium ion is expensive. These batteries are making their way into more and more products. They are it's the basis not just of the Prius, but also of the extremely expensive Chevy Volt. And it's part of the reason the Chevy Volt price tag is so high. And it was actually much higher 3 years ago, which is why they delayed release of it for so long. And that's GM's entire forward strategy right now, basically. I mean, they are working in diesel, they're working in, you know, increasing fuel efficiency behind the regular cars. But yes, lithium ion just makes its way into more and more devices. It's a little bit scary because we're not exactly, it's made of a bunch of different rare earth materials. So I would agree with you. I'm bullish on lithium ion battery repair as well.
Okay. I had a thought. Let's let our listeners take a crack at you, at least ask you one or two questions, and then I have a final question, then we're going to let you go. So, dear listeners, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Patrick Tucker. He is the deputy editor of The Futurist magazine and content director of the World Future Society's website, WFS.org. If you've been listening to this and you have a question or a comment for Patrick, we would welcome hearing from you. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. For a couple of comments I wanted to make about the previous thing you said. You talked about the $40,000 Chevy Volt, and it is. I mean, that's just a subcompact car. And it seems to me, well, I guess what I'd really rather ask you about is, you said, you know, you could have some system that's going to give people advice as to how they could make more of their batteries, but shouldn't that be automated? That there should be an automatic, let's say, if you know that a battery is being used in a certain way, shouldn't there be some little computer chip that automates optimizing how that battery is used, rather than just advisory, at least have the option of it being automated?
Well, the installation of the device, whether it's a actual sensor or a program, is something that happens manually. But in the case of a program, it's something that the user could just download. But there's a lot of different instances where it's not necessarily something that would be automatic. Let me give you an example. I've got this friend. He's an awesome guy. His name is Ted. And he just spent the last 3 months in Afghanistan going to the forwardmost operating bases of the Marines. And what he's doing is taking a look at these huge diesel-run generators that they've got there and analyzing, putting these devices on them that analyzes how much juice they're actually using. These are Marine bases that are really in the hills of Afghanistan. They are really far out, and resupplying them with diesel to run these generators is a huge headache. It's a huge strategic vulnerability, and the military right now is really keen on decreasing that vulnerability. So they sent my friend Ted out there to put their different sensors and variety of different devices on these generators to determine where that pull is coming from. I mean, how they're using energy and all the different ways they can make that base more efficient. So this is something that can only be done, I mean, once manual, because the equipment is really tricky. And the task, depending on the size of the base, is extremely complex. So in that instance, you absolutely need a person to do it. You need a sort of brave person. But there are a lot of different instances where you can create for a company, for an institution, an overall profile or proposal for energy efficiency using lots of these different systems, apps, and devices.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and, of course, Patrick Tucker, the deputy editor of the Futures magazine. We are on the show. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you very much.
Sure.
I have a question for the guest. I get concerned about instances where people are suggesting that the future for American workers is in increasing efficiency or the finer points on things or working on information about information. For instance, if we all were to take a case which obviously is exaggerated for the point of trying to make the point, if we all were increasing the efficiency of machines, but all of those machines were made in China, our economy would completely deteriorate. I don't mean to suggest that that's happening. I only offer it as an exaggeration to promote to have the guest comment on the danger, on the, what I see as a potential danger in being satisfied with that kind of knowledge.
So the question is, Patrick, is, you know, if especially is this question essentially of is it it's a Buy America argument? What's your reaction to the caller?
Well, I think that the erosion of the U.S. manufacturing base at this point in history, we're able to look back and say that was something that we shouldn't have let happen. It was a job. It was terrible for this country in a lot of different ways. In order to innovate a product, it's helpful to be part of the, you know, manufacturing stream. So the degree to which we allowed our manufacturing base to erode is a problem. But it's not something that is permanent. There's, I think, in the next few years, you're going to find a lot of different ways where just manufacturers in the United States, including garage manufacturers, are going to be able to wrestle some of that back. And that is going to help us in terms of design and in terms of innovation when we start making things here once again. In order to get from where we are now to there, you have to sort of switch the discussion from finding the cheapest labor pool to developing customizable products or lower value products much more cheaply, much more efficiently. And automation and robotics is one potential avenue to help that happen, which would, in some small way, help us wrestle some of that manufacturing base back from countries where it migrated to a dozen years ago.
I want to thank you for the call. You know, one of the things that he does say that is implicit, which is, I think, the important last question I want to ask you, which is this, you know, the notion of efficiency and greater machines and ever more technocentric is implying a, no matter what we say about, you know, people who don't need to be super technical, but as some, I spend a lot of time dealing with people in the full end of the, let's call it the socioeconomic continuum and education continuum, and there's a lot of folks who have trouble just getting up in the morning, who have trouble just showing up at work who could be clerks. I am worried as a human being about a potential race to the bottom in which to make a middle class living in the United States is going to require significant ability and willingness to keep learning the latest, if not technical skills. You need to be a pretty driven, well-adjusted, smart, lifetime learner. I'm worrying that many Americans, especially when it costs so much to hire an American versus somebody in China, for example, perfectly good people, are not able or not willing to compete for that in that, and let alone sustain it for a lifetime. As a futurist, what's your prediction for those millions of Americans?
It gets easier, and because the learning mechanisms get easier, the different methods for accessing education become much more convenient. I know a guy named Alex Peake. He's coming to our conference next year in Toronto, which is something you can learn about on our website. And he developed a video game that teaches you JavaScript. Okay, this is an example. There are more fun video games, but this is awesome. So if right now, it's like I said earlier, there are a lot of people that are turned off to new learning because they had a terrible experience in a crummy school where it was working off the Victorian model, where they were expected to sit in the desk, perhaps in the front, perhaps in the back, and they failed education, education failed them, and it was just a mutually bad relationship. It was like a bad romance. And in the 21st century, education moves away from that. It moves away from this thing that only happens a certain period of your life, and you only, if you succeed at it or you fail at it, then this determines the rest of your life. And it becomes something, hopefully, fluid and organic. I have to be an optimist. To be a futurist is an optimist. And I think we're going to see much more of that. So people will increasingly learn and get better at the things they want to get better at all the time. And it won't feel like a huge challenge. It'll feel like this joyous act that they participate in with other people.
and it will feel organic, and they'll realize the benefits from that in a lot of different ways. I, like I said, though, destined to be optimistic, because if you're not an optimist, then you're not going to make a good futurist.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. I'm not quite as optimistic as you are, but I certainly share your goal, and hope. Anyway, Patrick Tucker, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. He is the deputy editor of The Futurist magazine, and you can see their content of the World Future Society, including some sample content from the Futurist magazine, at WFS.org, as well as some of the hopefully curated list of, he said, 400 or so of these online courses that he's banking on as being critical for adults who want to stay current and perhaps be prepared for the next, quote, big thing. WFS.org. Again, Patrick Tucker, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Hey, thank you, Marty. It was a pleasure.
Good. Be well. All right. And now we turn to you, my dear listeners. If you would like a 3-minute career makeover, you need some career help, the only common denominator in your question has got to be, it's got to be career related. You're unhappy for the lack of a career. You're unhappy in your existing career. Self-employment, struggling, or wondering whether you should go into self-employment. Anything work-related, that's what you call for a 3-minute career makeover. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, certainly this is the holiday time. And I've had I had a client just Friday who said, you know, the people that I've been speaking to try to get a job, they're really not interested until the new year. I feel that it's pretty important that I share with you that, in fact, on average, while every individual is different, the holidays are the very best time to look for a job. Not only because all of those holiday parties, office holiday parties and otherwise, are great times to tell people you're looking for a job, but in fact, more often than not, and it's not, you know, no, there is no sure bets, but you are more likely, the closer we get to Christmas, the more likely you are to find somebody sitting at their desk willing to take your call. And maybe even in the holiday spirit. But I want to take a moment to talk a little bit about what I would do if I were going to a holiday party. And I'm not Mr. Social. I'm not. I like to sit and write in my home office as much as I can when I'm not seeing clients. But if I were looking for a job or needed career help, what I would be doing would, no question, be I'd go to as many of these holiday parties, work and otherwise, as possible. And unlike the conventional wisdom says, you know, don't bring up too early you're looking for a job because you need to first develop a proper relationship. I understand that, and there's legitimacy to that position. But you never really know when the right time to pitch is for that you're looking for a job. So my way would be, early on in conversations with folks, I would say that I am, and I would paint it in as positive a way as I can. I certainly don't want to sound like I'm bellyaching. But I would say something like, you know, I am looking for my next job. And this time, rather than take what's going to fall in my lap, I'm really going to search for what I want. Here's what I'm looking for. And then don't ask for help. Don't ask for advice. Don't ask for a lead. But you drop that there early on, and they may pick that up right away. You may be talking to somebody at a holiday party over the eggnog for 3 or 4 minutes, but you've gotten that out there relatively soon without being so audacious as to ask for advice. So I like the idea of mentioning that you're looking for a job early, and then, unless they pick right up on it, change the topic and listen to them. Ask about them, because it should not be all about you. And then, perhaps, if at the end of the conversation, if after you've shown that you're a good listener and a supportive person and or funny and or a good storyteller and or intelligent, then you might appropriately ask if by any chance you happen to know somebody you think I should chat with. Of course, I'd welcome hearing from it. I like that model. It's a little different than the standard model, and I just thought I'd pass that along. The phone number, again, if you would like a 3-minute career makeover, you have any kind of work-related problem, that is a core function of this show, is to help you individually. The first half of the show talks about big picture issues, talks about careers in general or careers that are booming or anything that is of broad interest to you, my dear listeners. But this part of the show is about you as an individual. So if you need some career help of any sort, I usually can at least help you take a baby step forward. This is the time to call. The phone number here for what I call a 3-minute career makeover on Work with Marty Nemco is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. How can I help? Hello.
Hi.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Hi, my name is AC, and I'm almost near retirement age, and I've been doing like low-level administrative work all my life. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about going back to school to do counseling, which you can't do unless you have a master's degree. So I would like to kind of have an idea, you know, maybe I'm not doing the right thing. You know, I've already applied for a couple of schools, but I definitely want to change careers. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm older, not a spring chicken. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about debt. I'm thinking about, you know, how do these careers, you know, kind of going to be navigated through this new economy, since everything that deals with counseling has been cut back.
Yeah, I like the phrase, you're not a spring chicken, you're an autumn chicken.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of more gray hairs and, yes, you know, sleeping more, that kind of thing.
Yes, I know all about that. I am fully aware of the cost. I was just, I go and hike around the Lafayette Reservoir every day with my doggy Einstein, and there are some regulars there, and one of the regulars is a guy named Alex. And Alex, he proudly told me that he was just admitted to the library science one-year master's program at San Jose State. And he mentioned that the total cost, when including books and everything, is going to be $35,000. This is at a tax-supported public institution for a one-year degree and librarianship, where it's so difficult to get a job, and even if you get one, it pays crappy. So I'm very well aware of what you're saying about the cost, and as you're approaching retirement, to be, you know, even at a public institution, to be contemplating a program, man, those programs tend to be 2 years long, and then a year of internship, which is unpaid. Right. You know, it could make you a bag lady by the time you're 70. So the good news is that there are alternative paths for counselor types that do not require a degree of any sort. And that is the coaching profession. It's one of the few professions that is relatively, if not completely, unregulated by licensure requirements. So I want to ask you a few questions that is going to help tease out what kind of coaching you might do that would enable you to do what you want to do and utilize your skills without having to incur what could be $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 worth of debt. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So teach me about, let's say there was a goddess. And the goddess was, can I ask what your first name is?
AC,
that's right. AC, if the goddess were looking down upon you, what kind of problems, what kinds of people would the goddess say that AC has a natural gift for coaching?
I definitely find that I have a good level of patience with adults that are dealing with issues of just kind of like lightweight changes, like what should I do here, what should I do here, what path should I go here, how do I tease out this issue, how do I kind of like tease it out so I can kind of make a decision about something.
Right.
And also issues around spirituality, which mm-hmm. I'm pretty good about, you know, listening to.
Okay. And so does it matter whether those not, you said lightweight issues, whether they pertain to relationships, career, money, God, as you say, spirituality, or are you roughly equal in your natural ability in all of those areas?
No, I'm not natural in those abilities as far as like finances. I'm not a good money manager. I got D's in math. Mm-hmm. So, you know, more the lighter things.
But career and spirituality and relationships all equally.
Yeah.
Now, we live in a world where there's so many coaches, it is extremely important to pick a narrow niche. Now, you said you've spent your life, your entire career, as a low-level admin was the term you used.
Yeah.
What if I said what you want to do is help low-level admins to cope with life, a lifetime. They're not ready to change careers. In this economy, it's very scary to change careers. But there is a pool of people who are admins. I'm thinking about, I've had a number of clients who are legal assistants, for example, working in a law office, which is very stressful because you're dealing with high-powered, aggressive kind of lawyer types.
Yeah.
And there you have admin types. And it can be a very psychologically stressful life.
No kidding.
Okay, so it sounds like you've been there yourself. Okay.
Yep.
So what if I said that your niche for coaching should be dealing with the day-to-day issues of being an admin in stressful environments?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you could be an effective coach in that and would enjoy it?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be no problem.
So what I would like you to do is, for starters, I am a huge believer not in rumination but in low-risk actions. So I want you, I don't want you to get off the phone and say, oh, Marty Nemco said do this, I want to do this. No, no, this is just a, something to investigate. So as soon as you get off the phone, I'd like you to go and I'd like you to Google the term personal coach training, and I'd also like to Google the term personal coach to administrative assistants or personal coach to secretaries or whatever. I'm sure there are other people somewhere in this great world of ours who is doing exactly that. See how they describe what he or she is doing career, how they market themselves, what are the services they provide, how do they price, what do they do? Do they do individuals? Do they do groups? Do they do online? That will help you without costing you a dime.
Yeah, I'm online now.
To experience what the options might be in that general space. You may change what you, this is just the first draft of a concept, but the more you do some of that internet searching, and then perhaps maybe you'll find the website of somebody who's a personal coach and you too, who maybe specializes in admins or people like that, or paraprofessionals of various sorts, and you resonate with what that person writes on her website or his website, and you could pick up the phone and you have a chat with them, or if they're local, you have coffee with them. And this is like the start of a journey where you gather little bits of information from what you read, from who you talk with, and the plan iterates into something that makes AC feel like, ah, this I could see being a useful thing to transition to without having to spend $70,000 becoming a counselor. And you can do it on the side while you're still paying the monthly rent by being doing the admin work that is sustainable for you right now.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, AC?
Yeah, that makes sense. I could, you know, check it out and see how that goes. And the other option I was thinking of, just really, you know, seeing how much scholarships might be available for someone who's in their mid.
They're generally not.
Yeah.
There's generally, you know, most, there's a remarkably little money for, you know, in an under, in a profession where there is a great shortage. So in other words, if they're looking for pediatric neurologists who are willing to work in, an, or in a rural area, there may be special kinds of incentives.
Yeah.
You know, but for somebody who is nearing retirement age who wants to be a counselor, I, you know, at least in the experience with my clients, that there are, you cannot count on a significant amount of cash. There's loans, they're willing to take your loans, but remember, higher education lobby is the most, one of the most powerful lobbies in America, and they have managed to lobby the government that make, that makes it, it, the only kind of loan you cannot discharge through bankruptcy is student loan. So once you go to school and you take on that loan, that loan is yours until the day you die or pay it off.
I've been reading about it, and it seems like they'll go into your Social Security, they'll go into anything and everything until you're out in the street kind of thing.
And that is why some, there is some legitimacy to the occupiers' protest. Maybe the core reason the occupiers started was, yes, indeed, the corporate malfeasance, but also higher education's dishonesty in kind of subtly saying, hey, you spend $100,000 or $200,000 on us and give us your 4 to 6 years of time, and you'll make at least a reasonable living. And they, so many people are graduating with nothing, to, with no job that they couldn't have done out of high, except out of high school, without a high school diploma, with a high school diploma, and they have the time to occupy, and they are really angry at the higher education machine. It is time to rage against that higher education machine, it seems to me.
I totally concur, and I'm thinking, why didn't I do this sooner, you know? So it is what it is now, though.
Well, and yes, and so we need to both think locally and act globally. So, act locally and think globally. So, you know, before you give them the $70,000, it is a political act as well as a personal act to see if there's a way to achieve your career goals without giving more money to the machine.
Yeah, I will try to do something. All right. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hello. It's you.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
How can I help?
I'm a landscape designer and contractor in San Francisco. I specialize in small gardens, mostly because I live in San Francisco, so small residences
seem
to be what I have done.
Right.
And over the past year or so, business has gotten much slower, and a lot of clients have said, I love your business, but I can't afford it anymore.
It's a luxury. In a tough economy, it's one of the first things to go. Landscape design is lovely. I love plants and landscapes and irrigation and all that stuff, but in this economy, it's a luxury.
It is. So I actually have a degree in education, but I was never very good at teaching, so okay. I can never do it.
Okay.
So I'm now wondering if I need to consider a different career or find a different way to make this business work.
Okay. So given that I'm looking at the time here, we have about 2 minutes left. We can choose. Do you want me to help you come up with a completely different career, or you want me to try to help you optimize landscape design?
Let's come up with optimizing landscape design.
Okay. And so clearly in the Bay Area, there's a couple of mega trends. And again, in this era of specialization, there certainly is the notion of xeriscaping, focusing on native plants, organic plants. No, low water use, xeriscaping means, you know, obviously for the listeners who don't know, you know, not limited little water. Is it worth your focusing on what is the Bay Area mega trend in the environmental sustainable direction, or have you already done that?
I really have already done that.
Okay. Now, the other thing is, in a tight economy, the people who survive, alas, and it makes me puke, it's the people who have schmoozed and developed relationships. Have you developed enough relationships, perhaps even with government is, you know, despite, I was just reading a study that said even though everybody else is losing jobs and government net is losing jobs, the government has acted, federal employment, there's been 30% more federal employees since 2007 than before 2007. So had you thought about trying to schmooze, develop relationships with people in charge of hiring landscape designers for government projects? For,
yeah,
or
that's
for government
something I
buildings.
Have not done.
Okay.
No.
So I would try to find out, I don't know who in the world they are, but if you could do some of the research to find out who are the decision makers in local, state, and federal government that that are in charge of deciding, you know, oh, this landscape needs to be redesigned, or we need to create a xeriscape, we're using too much water, we need to replace this lawn with something that's more environmentally responsible. If you could develop relationships with those people, it seems to me that that may be a new area to utilize that those values that seem to be just growing and dominant in our society. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
Okay, definitely. Well, given the limited time we have, I wish you the best of luck with that. I hope it's helpful.
Thanks so much.
Take care. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-Minute Career Makeovers, and I've got a very special guest, one of my favorites. I very rarely ask somebody back. I've asked this guy back, and he's terrific. He is Guy Kawasaki. He is one of Apple's early evangelists, one of the very first employees of Apple, but he's gone on to become maybe, in my judgment, the most sophisticated and savvy networker and knowledge about how to network, both in the online space, everything from Google Plus to Facebook to LinkedIn to in person. He's extremely personable, extremely smart, and he's written a great book called Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts and Minds and Actions. He will be my guest next week on Work with Marty Nemko. Please join me for that. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.